Tell me, Mr. John Brooks, where and when you were born.
I was born in London in March 1937.
And who are your parents?
Ronald Brooks, who ended up as chairman of the Commercial Union, and my mother was, maiden name was Payne, Iris Payne. They married, I don't really know, I suppose in 1930 or somewhere. Mm.
Did your family have a long-standing involvement in the city?
Yes. The Brookses originally were tea merchants, essentially from Ceylon. They had a tea company, and I think they originally, I think there were about eight small insurance companies that got together and were originally formed into the Commercial Union, and of which one of the Brooks family companies was one, hence our relationship with the Commercial Union.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have an elder brother and sister. My brother works in Clymore Benson, and my sister is married and is a housewife.
Mm. Had your brother originally been a banker?
No, he never worked in the family business. Because my father, it was sort of running out of steam, the sort of merchant, tea merchant side of it. And father never thought that it would be enough work for any of us to go in and do. And so my brother went straight into, it was Robert Benson Lonsdale, I think, and then they were merged with Climorts. So he's been in the merchant banking world all his working life. I went straight from national service into the stockbroking world.
Where had your parents sent you to school?
I went to Eton, which I left in 1955, and then national service for 2 years.
What had been the attitude to a career in the city, or more specifically a career in the stock exchange among your peers at school? What they have felt about that?
I think it... in the 1950s and early 60s, it was, I would think, the majority of people at school were going to end up somewhere in the city.
And people didn't really differentiate between different types of activity in the city?
Not really at school, I didn't think, no. It was just... you were probably just going to end up in the city. You didn't actually know what part of the city or whatever, but that was probably where you were going to end up.
Had you already made a decision at that stage, towards the end of your school education, what you'd like to do as a career?
No, I hadn't. I was an absolute washout. I had no idea what to do. But because there was 2 years of national service, one had a bit of time. Additional time to sort of consider and talk to people and find out what were the options, really.
Which firm did you join?
I joined Hoare & Care.
And how did that happen?
That was through a friend of the family who worked in Hoare & Care, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
Could you briefly describe the different stages in your career with Hoare & Co. from whatever, well, if you were working in the office, whatever you're doing in the office, through Blue Button and so on?
Yeah, certainly. I joined in September 1957 and started off in the messenger department for a month, which was literally just walking around the city with a fairly senior messenger to find one's way around the city, discover where most of our major clients' offices were. Also to a general education in where the pubs were and that sort of thing. And then after a month of that, I had probably 2 months going around the general office business department, sort of transfers, bearer department, accounts, all that sort of thing. Having done that, I think I probably joined Hoare & Co. and they were expecting me always to go down to the market as a dealer. So they then sent me down to the box in the stock exchange as a blue button. I did that for about 6 weeks, and then I was sent up to Edinburgh to work for British Assets, Ivor and Syme, for 3 months, which was really just sort of experience and seeing the other side of stockbreaking. I mean, how a client works, the sort of ideas that they're given, the sort of information they want, etc., etc. So I had 3 months up there, and then I came back and continued as a blue button on the floor of the stock exchange. I can't remember exactly, but I should imagine I was a blue button for about 18 months, 2 years, and then became a dealer. I think I became a member of the stock exchange in 1962-3, I think, but I mean, one could check that. I then continued dealing and became senior partner dealer in about 1968, when my boss retired. And then I remained as senior partner dealer, or senior dealer being a partner, not senior partner, from then right through until about 1984, when Big Bang was looming, and we'd sort of gone through a merger with John Gavette and become Hoare Gavette, and then sold 29% of ourselves to Security Pacific in 1983-84, I think it was. Then with Big Bang approaching and obviously a considerable change going to happen to the dealing end of the stock exchange, I became instrumental in selecting a small jobber to purchase, which was C.T. Pulley, and to help them expand from a very small base through 85, 86, to becoming one of the... They were never accepted as the equal of the first six. There was always the five, and then there was Pulley after them. There was quite a lot of opposition to Hoare Gavette sort of building them up or assisting Pulley in becoming large, because obviously other jobbers felt that we were favouring Pulley and showing them our business first, which wasn't true. Obviously there were one or two occasions when we were able to help them and they were able to help us. And then as we approached Big Bang and we were having to go onto computer screens and all that sort of thing, I came out of the market and became in charge, I became managing director of Hoare Gavette Securities, which was the broking and the jobbing arm put together on the administration side of it. And had to try and organize computer and the screens and get them to get the experts to produce what we wanted rather than what they felt that we wanted, and build a dealing room and get the telephone system all correct for the salesman, all the sort of fairly boring routine stuff, but which had to be done within a set time limit, which was quite testing. And then in the meantime, Peter Meinitzhagen remained in charge of the sales and overall trading, the actual physical business side of it. We then continued with myself in charge of the admin and him in charge of the actual sort of commission business and business through until 1988, when I retired in the summer.
How would you describe the firm when you joined it in the mid-50s?
It was, it had about 70, 80 people in it. I think it was looked upon as one of the best firms built up by Kit Hall. Certainly it had a very good new issue business with a list of really top-class companies such as ICI, Distillers, Vickers. It was, we had a reputation, a very good reputation, I think, for being able to raise money for these companies. We certainly had some bumpy rides, but managed to sort of we never in fact cancelled an issue, although at one point I knew that we were stuck on, there was a bank rate fuss in 1960, or it might have been 1957. Yes. I knew that we had a large fixed interest issue, I think it was for Vickers, going on at the time, and bank rate changed in the middle of it, which put everything absolutely in a complete stick. And we were strongly recommended by, I think, everybody that we should cancel the issue. And we actually said, no, we would stand by it. And we went for it and got through it, I think, and quite a lot of brownie points from the city generally for sticking by what we'd said we could do. I think even in those days, obviously there were Casnove and Rome Pittman and ourselves, I think, were probably looked upon as the three top firms. Mm. I think Casnove is probably always looked upon as number one. Mm. I think Rome Pittman and ourselves changing. And certainly in terms of the amount of business we were doing, I mean, it was sort of even Steven. One year, Ray Pitt would be number two. 1 year, we'd be number two. It was, we were all very much on a par, all with a very good list of clients.
Did you have much in the way of a research department during the earlier stage of your career with the firm?
I think we're probably the first firm to actually push research. We started a thing called DataStream, which must have been in the late 50s, early 60s, which was a research-based computer system, very much ahead of its sort of era, really. And this entailed having a substantial, or building up a substantial research department, and also a substantial computer sort of boffins area. Mm-hmm. So I think in the early 50s, we didn't have very much of a research effort. It was probably a sort of man and a dog. Mm-hmm. But from about the mid 50s or end 50s onwards, we had a gentleman called Bill Benton who was very much instrumental in the research side, in setting it up and saying that we really ought to take research rather more seriously. And then, of course, Graham Blees came in on the data stream side to set that up.
Well, let me shift the focus onto your career again and ask you what your first contacts would have been with the jobbers. During your career, jobbing clerks as well as jobbing
really dealers. One's first contacts were as a blue button, where one was basically a general dog's body, and you kept out of the way of the senior men on the jobbing pitches. Mm. It was really a matter of getting to know which job has dealt in what. There was a famous little book called Squirt's Guide, which you could sort of look up any stock and it would tell you who the jobbers were who dealt in that particular thing. I mean, it took quite a lot of getting to know who dealt in what. I mean, you could have anything up to 8, 9, or 10 jobbers dealing in the same stock. Well, I mean, a lot of them would be a very small, it would only be interesting dealing in very small amounts. There would probably be 3 or 4 jobbers who would take you on in a sort of institutional type of mind. But really, it was getting to know A, where these jobbers' pitches were, B, who dealt in what, and C, it was getting to know the jobbers' blue buttons and junior dealers who, you know, if one was going to remain in the business, one was going to grow up with. And it was very important, or in my view, it's very important to have a good personal relationship with your opposite number, be you a broker or a jobber. Because if you actually hated each other, you weren't going to be a great success as a dealer.
What was one's attitude to the jobbers at that stage? Did you regard them, in a sense, as the opposition, or were they people who one cooperated with and collaborated with?
No, I think in the early stages, one hadn't got round to the sort of thoughts of competition or perhaps greed or indeed perhaps profitability wasn't under pressure. And, you know, you could make a living as a broker or you could make a living as a jobber, be it a small one or a big one. And so one hadn't at that stage started looking at one's own profit and loss accounts and wondering or realizing maybe that you weren't making ends meet and we had to start sort of screwing someone somewhere in order that we could make more money. And I mean, I'm sure the jobbers would say that, you know, they did the same as in the later years, in the 70s and onwards. But no, early on, you looked upon them really as an essential part of dealing. I mean, you had the jobbers there. You, as a dealer, you got on with some or all of them. You needed to be able to deal with them. They were quite helpful. The spreads in the old days were much closer than they are now. There were no spread agreements or anything like that. And one actually felt, you know, everybody was working for the same thing. And you know, if we could make a little bit of money on commission and they could make a bit of money on the jobbing turn, you know, that's terrific.
Mm-hmm. Were the jobbers regarded as an important source of information on securities and on the way the different markets were doing?
They were very helpful in terms of your own companies that you acted for or were broker to, and you know, you could go and talk to the jobber and ask him what had been happening and whether there'd been much activity, turnover or whatever, and they would tell you 9 times out of 10, honestly. I mean, I'm sure that occasionally there could be a conflict where, you know, they'd been nobbled by someone who maybe was trying to build up a stake or something, and you know, you couldn't really expect them to come and tell you. Equally, they would often volunteer information which would be useful to the company or to us as brokers to the company, saying that, you know, there is a big buyer in, maybe just an investment buyer or whatever, or there's, you know, there's been no trade in this one for a long time and suddenly we're seeing quite a lot of interest. It's purely market information, but it's quite useful to know. And it sometimes is an early warning sign that there's a predator around. Not so much in those days, because there wasn't the frenetic takeover activity that there subsequently happened in the sort of late 70s, 80s.
Where did one learn one's skills as a broker-dealer?
I think purely, I mean, the older dealers in one's own firm, I mean, some were good, some were not so good, but the good ones were always prepared to sort of give advice. In fact, initially, obviously, you weren't allowed to do the big business. I mean, you started off as a private client dealer or a country broker dealer or something like that, doing small orders, which you probably couldn't really get into trouble doing. If you had a bigger order, you certainly, in our firm, you would consult with the senior dealer and say, look, I've got this one, do you know, I'd rather you did it, or should I have a go? And if they say, yes, you have a go, you'd say, well, I thought I'd go and try so-and-so and, you know, and do this and that. And they'd say, either agree with you and say that that's the right thing to do, or they'd say, well, actually, you know, I wouldn't do that. Why don't you try doing something else? It's purely experience and yes. practice yes. at it.
Were you specialising in any particular markets?
No. We in our firm didn't specialise. Some firms did have dealers who, you know, the dealer, that chap does breweries, that chap does chemicals or whatever. We, in fact, didn't. We had dealers who specialised in dealing for clients, for the merchant banks, who were have always been fairly active traders and they have their own dealing department. We had designated dealers who would do all Kleinwort's business or Morgan Renfrew's business because the merchant bank liked talking to one chap on the floor. And we had other institutional dealers who would do any institutional business for the sales, for the institutional sales. They would know there were four people and you could ring any of those four and they would deal in any stock, you know, that is required. We specialised in so much that we had separate dealers for gilts, obviously, and for fixed interest, and I think for investment trusts, which were different, slightly different animals each.
So for the private client business, when you were first starting off, were you dealing in general British equities?
Yeah, we were always a sort of nearly completely UK orientated firm in terms of what we were dealing in.
And in handling the smaller bargains at that stage, would you check your price with all the jobbers in that particular market, or did you only go to the ones who handled the smaller business?
You would probably go to the smaller jobbers for the smaller business, and you might check the price with one, possibly two others. But I mean, if you're dealing in 200 shares, and you deal a halfpenny wrong, I mean, it's not actually the end of the world. but also you have it depends on the volume. I mean, you can actually have a terrific volume of private client orders coming in, and you physically haven't got time to go and check all the prices because it's just all day you're doing small bargains, and as soon as you come back to the box to report them, you're given another great wad of them. But you would certainly check the price once, if not twice.
How did you find the jobber's attitude to you as a younger dealer? For example, when you went up to a pitch, who would you go and talk to? Would you go and talk to their authorised dealer, or would you go talk to the member dealer? Or
it would depend the sort of bargain that you've got, or what you actually want to talk to them about. basically, you would, as a ordinary deal, institutional dealer, you would probably go to one of their. They'd be a member dealer, because I mean they. Most of the jobbers were members anyway. But you wouldn't go to the senior boss man. You'd go to someone in the middle, either a young one on the way up or a sort of middle-aged one. you would find, I mean, you were actually treated terribly well by the senior jobbers, because, I mean, they knew always within the breaking firms who was liable to be doing the institutional business, and, you know, it was in their own interest to encourage the breaker dealers to, you know, if one thought the boss was a jolly nice chap, you'd actually go and see him if you've got a problem or possibly. So, but I mean, they were actually extremely nice. They were very helpful. But it was, I think it was all part of the sort of back to the people business, that it's essential to get on. And it was in their own interest that they encouraged the young institutional dealers to come there.
Did you find, again, I suppose, with reference to your earlier days, that there were individuals, jobbers, who were particularly difficult to deal with, they'd either try and open you, or that they'd never quote a reasonable size or the size that you'd want to make it in?
There were one or two who one found slightly more difficult than others, but that was, I think, in my view, they were normally the senior partners, perhaps, of one or two firms. That is slightly the exception rather than the rule, who one just was a little bit frightened of, and they were a little bit aloof, and you know, they would deal with you, but you'd ask a price, you'd get a price, and that was that. And in those circumstances, one probably didn't go to them because there were two or three other ones who you knew you could go, who would go to, who would be actually quite helpful. But really, it's all personalities, actually.
Yes. Did you have any particular disasters during your early dealing career? Or did you feel you had any particular successes?
plenty of both, I think. One, the sort, I mean, I don't think there were, oh, it's difficult to measure disasters or successes in terms of dealing or jobbing, I think, because what you're really a success is if you manage to buy 100,000 ICI shares a halfpenny cheaper than perhaps the chap around the corner. And it's pretty small bear, really. But it, you know, if you manage to do that, you feel quite pleased with yourself. This is a pretty small, minor achievement. I mean, I think more one has, you know, suddenly your heart sinks to your boots in things like new issues or the rump of an issue or something, where in the sort of 60s and 70s, this sort of put through and all that sort of thing, you know that there's 500,000 shares left over as a rump of a rights issue or something. Yeah. You know that upstairs your salesmen have got buyers for a million at least, and so you basically want the whole 500,000. And you have to go to a jobber or to all the jobbers who deal in that particular stock in that particular issue, and you have to talk to them and find out if they want any shares or anything. And you hit the first one who says, yes, I want all of them plus more. And you know your heart sinks because you know you're not going to get it right with the jobbers. You know you're not going to get it right with your own firm. And you're absolutely stuffed. I mean, you've then got to try and talk your way out of on one side or the other or come to a compromise, which you still know is not going to satisfy anybody. And then you go away and you think, well, you know, have I made nonsense of that, or you know, how could I have done it else in another way to achieve what I was actually trying to do? It's much more, you have a plan and it doesn't go according to plan. Those are the sort of disasters, I think.
Yes. Can you recall any particular example of that? I mean, not necessarily going into names if you didn't want to.
Yes, the first disaster was a rights issue in what is now Coates Viella. It used to be Carrington's, I think, or Carrington Viella, or and this, I think, was either when I just become. No, I think my boss had gone on holiday, so I, in theory, was in charge as a fairly new boy in the early 60s. And Wed Dalak had dealt in. Was it Wed? It might have been Dalak, or it might have been Wed Dalak. I'm not sure if they'd merged. Dealt in. Anyway, Wed Dalak had dealt in Carrington, so I went over. I had something like. 1.5 million shares to sell. Again, we wanted to buy them back. We had buyers for most of them. And so I went and saw Wed, and they made me a price in 25,000 or something. So I said, is there a bigger market? They made me another price in 100. And then they got up, I think, to 250,000. And so I, not really knowing the form, said, hey, well, I've got 1.5 million to sell. So you obviously have no objection if I put them through, because we've got buyers. Whereupon this gentleman said,